Shrink Wrap Radio number 600, The Future of Psychotherapeutic Apps, with psychologist Silja Litvin.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Silja Litvin, a UK psychologist who is also founder and CEO of Psych Apps. Her company's first project is EQ, an emotional fitness game for mobile devices. For more information about Silja Litvin, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Silja Litvin, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I am so happy to have this opportunity to speak with you because I think you're doing such exciting work. You're kind of one of the spearheads, I would say, of developing apps that are related to the whole realm of psychology and particularly psychotherapy. So very cutting edge. You're attending conferences all the time. You're at a conference right now in Berlin called the NOAA conference. I'm not familiar with that. Is NOAA an acronym, or what is the NOAA?
I don't think so. I think it actually means it's kind of like it's bringing everybody on board.
Okay.
Like in the arc, exactly. So that it's all about tech, but all the areas of the tech world, like Al Gore is going to be there, the CEO of Uber. You have transport, you have artificial intelligence, you have mental health. So it's everything in 2-day conference.
Yeah, well, NOAA is perhaps the appropriate designation because we do seem to be in a flood of change.
Yeah.
in the whole, our lives are being taken over in some ways by the whole digital revolution, if you will.
Yeah.
We knew it was coming. We knew it was going to change things, but in some ways it's come so much faster than we were prepared for, particularly in terms of legal issues, legal issues that the digital world is confronting us with.
Yeah.
And yeah, so it's amazing. Well, you are... Okay, I'll say it. I was thinking, maybe I should have you say it. Are you currently enrolled in your doctoral program? You were in a doctoral program in what, clinical psychology or some other branch?
Yes, exactly. So I'm still doing my PhD. If everything goes well, by the end of this year, beginning of next year, I'll finally have it. It's a very bad idea to do your PhD and start a startup at the same time.
Yes, I would say so.
There is not enough time in the world.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I am amazed by how much, in fact, you're doing. And you've created a company called Psych Apps.
Yeah.
Tell us about Psych Apps and what your vision for the company is down the road.
Yeah. Well, actually, Psych Apps started out as my PhD thesis. I wanted to do something a little bit outside of the box. So instead of in Germany, where I did my master's, usually when you do your thesis, you go to your professor and then you say, I'd like to do my thesis. And then he gives you a project from this pile of projects. And then you go and you do that project, right?
Yeah, on his research. Yeah, to carry out his research further. Yeah. You're a slave.
Yeah. Yes, a slave. You learn a lot, but you have to do a lot of work for an idea that is probably very interesting, but might not be your first choice, right?
Right.
And so I had always thought, I have a bit of a diverse background with my past. And so I have this idea that I wanted to do something a little bit outside the box. And I know that psychology is very... slow in a lot of areas, and I think it's important because it comes with a lot of responsibility, so it's good to be conservative. But yeah. I wanted to say, okay, I want to be, like you said, a spearhead. I want to go ahead and I want to try something new. And this was about 3 years ago, and at that time, the iPhones were just getting really big, and everybody was on smartphones, and apps were becoming a thing. And, you know, so I thought for the first time in the history of mankind, You have a platform that 60% of the population uses, and that would be the space that we should offer therapy. And I mean, even 3 years ago, people went to sleep with their phones next to their bed. They took the phone with them to the loo. It's like always there. It's the ultimate comfort zone. And so I pitched the idea to my professor and said, I would like to do an application. And I believe that if you do kind of like CBT or positive psychology therapy and you translate it to the digital form, that you can actually help a lot of people for a lot less money. And he was like, go for it. I was very lucky to have an open-minded professor. And
yeah, so, really. Hey, here's for open-minded professors. I was a professor for 35 years, and I tried to be open-minded.
Yeah. I mean, that you're doing this radio show already shows that, you know, you're reaching out, you're interested, you're open, and that is a gift for psychology, because that's the whole point, right? We want to know how people work and how everything, the behaviors and everything. So I started out the app, and then I kept on talking to people, and they said, oh, I wish I would have had that half a year ago, or I would need something like that for my mom, or it kept on. And then I looked at the market, and at that time there were maybe two or three programs out there. I don't know if you've heard of Super Better. There was the Big White Wall. It's web-based. And, I think there was one more, True Colors in Oxford University College. And so I thought, okay, three apps that are almost unknown. People have never heard about it. The market is there. Mental health or mental illness is on the rise. People are starting to be open for that. This is the time to do that. So we did the application, and we did a post and pre-evaluation, proper research with a test group and a control group. And we could prove that using the app on a certain amount of times significantly lowers depression levels. But when I started fundraising and I started speaking to investors, we had the problem that we couldn't prove that people stuck to the app. And you can't sell a product, or you can't develop a product that people don't stick to. And I thought, okay, I developed an application that is just, excuse my French, sucks, right?
Yeah. But now, is the app that you're talking about EQ? Is that how you pronounce it?
No, that is the new app.
Okay.
And yes, you pronounce it perfectly.
I just want to let the audience know why I asked about the pronunciation, because I heard one of your presentations on YouTube, and I thought, oh, that's interesting. That's easy to say. I was trying to say EQ or something like that. It's spelled EQUOO.
Yeah, exactly. We spent a lot of time trying to find a way how to spell it so that it's easy, but we weren't very successful with that. When people hear it for the first time, they're like, oh, of course. But, you know, sometimes when they see it, well, what is it supposed to be?
Yeah, well, EQ, you know, that's a concept now in psychology. Mm-hmm. And so that's a great name for it. And probably it would have been a problem for you to use it exactly, the letters EQ, probably would have conflicted with something. So I think you came up with a good solution. So I kind of interrupted you. So you're talking about the development as you're moving towards the current app EQ.
Exactly. And so we had this app, and we could prove that it was helping people, but people weren't sticking to it. And the best app in the world isn't going to help anyone if people don't stick to it, right? And so I thought it was my fault. I designed something that's boring, or, you know, just doesn't do any good. And I went back to the books, and I saw that most of all of the digital mental health products, digital health products, all have a problem with attrition. People don't stick to it. I don't know how many times you've downloaded an app for healthy eating or counting steps, and you use it for maybe 3-4 days, and then, you know, you kind of forget it. It goes into forgetting. And that's just because the brain is wired for social interaction, for novelty, for fun, right? And that's not given to these applications. So to be absolutely honest, end of 2016, beginning of 2017, I thought we're going to go bust. We wasted a year. We have a product. And then I met Philip Irwin, who is head of Collision Studios. And they are a proper gaming company in Los Angeles. They've worked on games like Walking Dead, Game of Thrones, Barbie, Scrabble. They have this huge portfolio of games and like
what
proper
was the
console
name of the,
games.
What was the name of the company again?
It's called Collision Studios.
Collision Studios?
Collision Studios, exactly.
Okay,
like
I
game
got it.
Development.
Yep.
And so he had, exactly that. And he had been looking for a psychological game for quite a while, but it never matched up. And so we got talking, and within a couple of weeks, we had signed our contract. I had raised £200,000, and we were off to making EQ, the emotional fitness game. And so what we're doing kind of is, in the startup world, is called a pivot. So you pivot away from the path you were on, and you go a different direction. And sometimes the pivot makes the product something completely different. And what I like to see right now is that we're doing a detour, because the gaming industry is kind of hacking the brain's reward system to get people addicted to games, right? They want people to come back. And my idea was that you can use all those evil little tricks to actually get people to stick to therapy, digital therapy. And so EQ now is a subclinical game. And that is where we are disruptive, is because usually disruption happens when you bring two unlikely fields together, digital mental health and gaming, which you would think are actually opponents, right? Because gaming isn't really good for your mental health. But actually, if you bring these together, you have a completely new product. And we're not just translating face-to-face therapy onto a digital platform. We're creating a new form of therapy that is using games to get people to stick to it.
Yeah, yeah. And I, fortunately, you sent me a code that let me go in and be a bit of a beta tester. And I didn't make it all the way through, but I did get to the first level or second level. I can't recall. And you use a lot of techniques that I know something about, not in terms of executing them, but I'm familiar with the concepts. I should let you know that one of the many hats I wear is market researcher. And I was particularly interested in getting into technical products. And so I started back in the early 80s doing market research. And one of the companies that I did some work for was Electronic Arts, and also Apple Computer at that time. So I really got my feet wet in a lot of that stuff. I was originally going to be an engineer, and I saw all this exciting stuff that was beginning to happen around digital products. And I thought, you know, how can I get into that field? Well, long story, somewhat shorter, I did some networking, and that led me to somebody who was a market researcher, and he brought me in. And I said, hey, I want to steer your business towards the technical end of things. Yeah. And so it's been quite a ride, because it gave me a kind of a front row on a lot of the technology that was developing. And so I just wanted to share that little bit of background with you. And so I see that you're using, like, one of the techniques, one of the, quotes, evil techniques that you're using is gamification, what's called gamification. And right now, people are trying to gamify everything. In the market research world, they're developing products to get people's opinions, et cetera, online. Mm-hmm. And they add gamification to it. People can earn points and levels and little badges and things like that. And I have mixed feelings about that. And maybe it's because of my age. I had it thought out more what my objection was.
Maybe that it's very short-lived and for the moment, and it's all about short attention spans.
I can see why it's particularly effective, probably on very young people, on teenagers and young adults. I think that for myself, and I don't know what the literature shows about gamification across a wide variety of products, but for me, it feels manipulative. I'm not interested in earning points. I'm not interested in earning little electronic badges and things like that. So for me, I don't think it works, although it might work more than I'm consciously willing to admit that it works.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to see what works for who and where you get a certain type of people hooked to something that I wouldn't have anticipated. When we designed the app, we thought that our target audience would be between 18 and 28, and that was just because that's most of the mobile game players are in that age range, and because that's when a lot of the mental illness manifests. But in our beta testers, we have about 3,500 beta testers in Australia and New Zealand. About 70% of them are men, 35 plus.
Yep. Oh, 35 plus, so it's older than you were expecting.
Much older than I expected. And we wanted to step away from the blue branding because all of the mental or all of the medical apps are blue, right? And so we said, okay, we're going to go into the purple. And it turned out the game looks a little bit more feminine, classically feminine than I had anticipated. So I thought it might be repellent to men, but not at all.
Well, one of the elements that's being used a lot in various areas, as well as your game, is storytelling.
Yes.
And they're doing that in market research as well.
Yeah.
But I found it very effective what you're doing. I've not seen that approach used in a psychological app before. And you've got some interesting stories. There was a story of the prince of a kingdom, and in the process of the story, one is challenged as you move through levels. So there are the levels where you're learning some psychological content.
Mm-hmm.
You drew on the work of John Gottman, and
Gottman.
Yeah, a very important work. I interviewed his wife, but didn't get through to him. Interesting work. And so I remember the lesson on an emotional bid.
Yeah.
And so then you move along to the story about the prince and his kingdom, and he needs to rid it of trolls. And somewhere in there you have to recognize that one of the statements that you can choose between is an emotional bid. So there's a psychological concept. I was familiar with that concept, but I'd kind of forgotten about it.
Yeah.
And so I didn't mind being having that sort of reactivated, and maybe I'll be more alert to it in my marriage. No promises, but...
One of the things that... I say the app does is, so the first part of the app is you learn a skill, right?
Yeah.
So in a way, what is therapy? You learn a new skill set to be able to deal with adverse emotional or mental situations, right? So you learn two skill sets, and it's in a fun gamified way with little people and drawings and stuff like that, and then a multiple choice. And then you have to use it in a choose your own adventure. So you're implementing what you just learned in a situation. And we have five different genres. So the first one is Dungeons and Dragons. The next one is, I think, sci-fi. Then there's an office story and so on and so forth. But the most important part of the game is actually when you put the game down, you go into the real life, and then a partner, for example, places an emotional bid. And you go, oh, I know what my partner is doing, and I know exactly how to react to that. And that is when the skill set has become part of your tool set, your psychological tool set.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think it's very interesting what you're doing and the way that you got training in systems family therapy, I gather.
Yes. Yes.
And also sounds like you've got a strong background in cognitive behavior therapy. Is that right?
Yeah, nowadays you can't really outskirt CBT. It's like everywhere.
Yeah, I know. Mm-hmm. And, my therapeutic interests really go across the board. So, so CBT is what's known as a manualized therapy, which is basically that it's been laid out in such an objective way that it's almost like you can follow a manual, at least at the most basic level. And a lot of people, myself somewhat included, would think, well, that's pretty limiting, to have to do such a rote thing. So I think one of the things I wanted to ask you about that might be a challenge for you is, how do you get beyond that, beyond a manualized approach for something that would fit into the category of, say, depth psychology?
Yeah. Well, I think that would be really something for the long run, the long picture, because right now where we're at, we're subclinical. So I'm starting a study that can show that the app acts preventative because it's giving you skill sets to deal with stress. The next version, the reason why I'm here in Berlin at the NOAA conference is because I want to raise 1.4 million to be able to add therapeutic features for depression and anxiety, because these are often comorbid. And then after that, we're going to go a bit deeper. But I would state, with what I have seen so far, what digital therapy can do and what I have seen my apps do, I think that we will be pretty much scratching the surface of low-level depression, low-level anxiety. And to be honest, I do believe that face-to-face therapy is the best. And one of the things that I want to do in the application is kind of lower the stigma and psychoeducate people that, you know, going to see a therapist is a good thing. It's positive. It's empowering. You know, it's part of the journey that can change your life in a very, very good way. And so I don't actually want to take away from the face-to-face therapy and to the in-depth therapy. I mean, if one day we're able to treat deep depression with an app, that was wonderful, right? Because then a lot of people who don't have the money or would be on waiting lists or live rurally or are too afraid to speak to someone could be treated. That those are all good things. But at the moment, I think it would be pretty much still scratching the surface.
Yeah, well, you make some great points there. And of course, I'm wondering too, if it could, you know, one of the things that's becoming very big now is telemental health, or, you know, in an environment like we're in right now, that's really exploding. I'm amazed to see how that's caught on. And for many of the reasons that you're spelling out, you know, that's, it's more convenient, it's less scary. A whole bunch of things that, and I've done some interviews around that.
Yeah.
And there might be ways to have a hybrid. That's I was going.
Yes, absolutely.
You're doing in the teaching, and then having the person, like that could be homework. The game could be homework for somebody who's going to meet in this kind of modality.
As we have the depression features in the game, it will actually be depression treatment. So a therapist could say, I would like you to play with this app for next week. Can you come back after you've done level one or two or something like that? That I can very well see that.
Yeah, me too. And you raised £200,000, British pounds, already?
Yes, exactly.
And now you're going for $1.4 million.
$1.4 million, yes.
And you are a real go-getter, I have to say. not only are you psychologically adept, but also, in this world of technology and marketing, how do you come by all of this skill and talent? And you look like a model, I have to say. You're a beautiful young woman. I have a feeling that's maybe playing a role in all this as well, in terms of going to conferences and so on.
Yes. I mean, if you go on my LinkedIn, it's pretty much on the bottom of my CV, but I did 17 years of modeling. And I think
Surprise. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I think that is the source of strength, because I, for 17 years, I lived more or less from day to day. I was self-sufficient. I was traveling by myself. I was living in cultures I didn't know. And I was getting very good at rejection. When you're modeling, in constant rejection, right? Maybe 5% of all the castings you go on are actually turned into jobs. And with fundraising, it's the same thing. And you can get very disheartened after the fifth investor says, no, I don't think this is going to work, right? Yeah. And then you meet that one investor that says, I love the idea. I love your team. And, you know, I trust you. Here's some money. So it's worth going out there and getting it. And I think also the idea came from that, because I come from this very commercial background of modeling, where it's all about, you know, selling and marketing and superficial, you know, getting people.
Yeah.
Not healthy at all. And then you have the academic side, which is research, and it's trying to help people, and it's trying to get to the bottom of things. And if that's actually the app, has to be like that, because apps that don't attract people and don't, you know, aren't entertaining aren't going to be able to actually help. And I think that mindset is quite unique amongst the mental health, because the big mental health apps aren't actually done by psychologists. They're done by people who have been through depression themselves and then thought they would have needed something like that, and so they went and developed it.
Uh-huh. Well, you're sort of a perfect storm of experiences and capabilities, I think.
That sounds wonderful. I'll take it.
Yeah, good. And, you know, I've seen some TV series about modeling and feature models, it can be a terribly dispiriting thing because the model is treated as an object. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, and so I don't need to tell you about that. So it's wonderful the way you have transformed that experience and blended it with other experiences. And I have to ask you, have you studied acting at all?
No, I haven't. I always thought it would be interesting, but I get terrible stage fright. And so after one or two plays, and I'm already dying a little bit inside for tomorrow.
Okay, well, you've done one or two plays. The thing that triggered that was that you have this alter ego avatar, Dr. Joy, who in some of your YouTubes, Dr. Joy shows up as a cartoon figure in EQ, in the app, but then in your actual body, you personify Dr. Joy, the avatar. And you're using a TV technique that's, I don't know how you do it, if it's green screen or what, but where we see you both in this persona and Dr. Joy with her glasses and her lab coat and all. And, you know, and that's just a very clever piece of marketing. And
That was actually my CTO, Matt Buki's idea. So he's a bit of a camera person. And he said, you know, let's do this. We need to be a bit more out there. We need to do little bits that are interesting and, you know, get people curious about the product. So that goes to him.
Yeah. Well, it was a great idea, I think. Now, one of the things that you will be integrating more into EQ, which, by the way, you refer to as an emotional fitness game.
Yeah,
for smartphones. So maybe I should have you expand a little bit on what do you mean by emotional fitness?
Yeah, so it's kind of, because it's at the moment it's still subclinical, it's not actually a mental health application per se, even though it does go into the mental health space. We could have called it a mental health application, but there is still a lot of stigma and fear out there and treatment resistant. And a lot of people that are not willing to reflect upon their own mental health, but could use emotional fitness. With this kind of branding, I thought long and hard about it. With this kind of branding, I think fitness has kind of this strength, positivity, health aspect to it. It helps people access the game and reap the benefits of the game without having, you know, jumping off because of the fear of mental illness or mental health.
Yeah, so, and you've also drawn from positive psychology, which is another movement I've kind of been following with great interest. And they've kind of carved out that space of making it less stigmatized.
Yes, exactly. And so we're outskirting a lot of the problems that mental health applications have. And trying to get a wider target audience to come and try it out.
Sure. Because we all face life challenges. We all could use resilience, for example.
Yes.
And probably benefit from some kind of resilience education and resilience training. And that's maybe just one area, and there are lots more.
Yeah. So, and I mean, it's fun. I mean, maybe I'm projecting too much because I love psychology, but learning something psychological that you can actually use in everyday life, usually when I tell people about emotional bits, and I put this first because it's an easy win, people go, whoa, really? That's amazing. And then they go out and they practice it with someone, and then I get a text 2 days later and said, I just reacted to an emotional bit. So it's intriguing, it's inspiring, it's motivating to learn psychological skills.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I would agree as a psychologist. I would have to agree.
I'm a preaching to the
choir. Yeah, yeah. Let's talk a little bit about AI. In one place you said AI is a buzzword. And I think in the context that you said it, you were meaning it as a good thing. In other words, that people are hearing it so much that they could enter into something that professes to be AI. There's another take I have on AI, though, that it's too much of a buzzword, that people are going to claim that they're using AI as a selling point. It'd be like new X47 in our toothpaste. Yeah. You must have X47. And AI, it seems to me, is there's a big risk that it's going to be like that. It's a good selling point. We have AI in our app.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that a lot of people, they get carried away with the, you know, the coolness of artificial intelligence. Yeah. And then they get drawn towards it. And then it's still in its baby shoes. You know, proper deep learning doesn't really happen maybe in two companies or three companies worldwide. It's more machine learning and natural language programming and things like that. But they sound less sexy than as artificial intelligence. I think I am using it to also attract investors, but then it's solid. We have a solid AI base. And I think this is an opportunity to just discover patterns that we haven't known yet in psychology that you can only do if you use artificial intelligence on a digital platform.
Yeah, I saw some of your discussion on that, I think, again on YouTube, and it kind of piqued my interest. One thing that you said is that machines now, AI, deep learning, are performing diagnosis more accurately on schizophrenia and depression than humans. Now, I haven't heard of that research.
Yes, I'm happy to send you a few links with it. It's quite mind-blowing. And actually, in areas that I would never have thought of, right? I think I've learned the typical inventory questionnaire style that you do with patients, right, as diagnostic tools. And one thing that, for example, IBM Watson uses is voice recognition. And they can actually tell by just having a conversation over a very short period of time. I don't want to say something wrong, but under 5 minutes, if that person is clinically depressed or not, or is having a schizophrenic bout.
Wow, that's very interesting. It reminds me of Gottman's work where with 5 minutes of observing a couple, he could predict whether or not they'd still be married in 5 years.
Yes, exactly. With an accuracy of 85%.
Yeah. And the research that I am familiar with was the ability to detect certain cancers by their look. But this part about detecting emotional issues. I hadn't heard of it. I meant to, actually, I'm now remembering, I meant to go and Google it before talking to you.
Yeah.
So I'll appreciate any links that you send me.
And it goes into a realm of questionable ethics and a lot of data and privacy questions that I am very keen on pushing the discourse towards, because, for example, there was a research in Stanford or Yale, I'm not quite sure, where they detected if someone was suffering from depression by their Instagram profile, by how many people were in the picture, what kind of captions, what kind of colors, what kind of filters, up to the point that they could predict if someone was developing a depression that hadn't actually manifested yet.
Wow.
And then you come to the question, like, do people want to know? Are we allowed to invade their privacy and point out that they are going to be suffering from a depression? Are we supposed to? What do we do with this power? Who actually manages this information? All these questions are monumental.
Right. And it drives us into the world of science fiction, where people have explored a lot of these issues, and, you know, science fiction writers. And I'm thinking of Minority Report. You know, and it seems like you could use the same technology to predict criminal behavior.
Yeah, there was an algorithm that can show on profile pictures if someone is homosexual or not. For us, it doesn't really matter, even though we can't be outing people who don't want to be outed, right? That is that is against the law. But if in countries where it's forbidden to be homosexual, it could be death threatening.
Yeah.
So, a lot of the algorithms out there, it's a little bit like Jurassic Park. Like, you know, they were so high on being able to do it that they didn't ask themselves if they should do it.
Yes, right.
There's a lot of responsibility.
Yeah, that's the conversation that a lot of people are trying to stimulate now.
Yeah.
Just because we can do it, does that mean we should do it? And, and of course, it's still an open question of, you know, can the genie be stuffed either back into the bottle or kept in the bottle?
Yeah.
Particularly given such a range of values that people have different values, different goals, etc.
Yes. Each culture has different values and different, you know, privacy settings and management and everything. I think there would have to be some kind of global artificial intelligence committee, ethics committee, that put down the law of how data is used, how the algorithms are used, who's programming the algorithms, because a lot of the algorithms that are being developed by, by white men, young white men. And I'm not saying that young white men are bad people, but sometimes they have biases and they program biases into the algorithms. And then the people that are being targeted by those biases will have issues in their lives, be it banking or finding a home or be it mental health, anything.
Yeah. Well, all of this suggests that you may have some hurdles down the road, right, with some of the things that you want to do that are well-intentioned and that are potentially might be very helpful, but you'll have to bend over backwards to justify it and try to...
Yeah.
I don't need to tell you that. I'm sure you already are hearing about that kind of thing.
Yes.
Let's see. I wanted to ask you about some other things. You did, you know, you're doing so many presentations. It was hard for us to set this up because you were doing a presentation every time that we talked. Oh, I'm going to Berlin now to do this presentation, and then I'm going to London to do a presentation and so on. And so you're having a very exciting life in that way.
Probably
meeting a lot of people. Meeting a lot of people, probably getting a lot of stimulation, you know, from if I go to a conference, boy, sometimes I get so amped up, you know. Yeah. It takes a while to settle down and for sort of reason to come in and, you know, realize like, well, I'm way overexcited about this. It's not really that big a deal. I don't know if you're going through any of that. So let's see. You gave a presentation on ethical tech. How can we design better humans? What can you tell us about that presentation? What were the...
That was a lovely panel put together by a committee that was interested in seeing how the tech world is self-managing their ethics. And it was a great panel. We had a company that did big data that was working with weapons, for example. Then there was a company, a guy who was working for a fintech company that was using artificial intelligence. There was a dancer and body sensory researcher was there, and I was there. And It was kind of just about like trying to map out a future where we have products that actually make people better and not worse. And I think one of the reasons why I was invited is because we at PsychApps are using technology to try to make better humans. And we're not trying to suck the person into the game and keep them there because then we can sell things to them and, you know, keep it running and show advertisement to them. But we actually want to give them something that they go out into the world and have better relationships and healthier relationships and are more successful in life. And I think what is happening, for example, with Facebook is a good thing right now because people are becoming aware that they are the product and they're not happy with that. And the GDPR that is happening in Europe and the UK, it was bad news for us because we lost all of our lists because we had old lists and people weren't filling out the consent forms that we were allowed to contact them again. But I think it's a very good thing because people are taking over the responsibility for their own data and becoming more aware of what's happening with it.
Yeah.
So I think it's our responsibility now that we have this possibility, like you said at the beginning, the marketing tricks and everything. We have that, but how can we actually add value to people's lives instead of just sucking them dry, you know?
Yeah. Where's your money going to come from? You're doing the fundraising, but this has got the product's going to have to generate income, right?
Yes. So we have about three revenue streams. The first stream that is in the app or is implemented right now. The next time you go on your app and you do an update, you'll see that you can actually buy exercises for the different skills. So if you like the skill specifically, then you want to practice them a little more, you can buy a skill set for 99 cents. And then in that skill set, you get to practice it for parenting at the workplace and for relationships. So it's like an in-depth practicing of what you've just learned.
Great. That's a good idea. So that's one stream. You said there are two more?
Another stream is corporate mental health. We want to work with big corporations and being able to offer that to their employees because absenteeism and presenteeism is a big, big problem for the economy. And, of course, for the families of the people that aren't going to work or aren't being promoted and having a bad time at work. And then the third one is working with insurance companies. And that one is a bit of a tricky one because I know a lot of people think insurance companies are trying to, you know, manipulate people. But in the game, when you play it, you get coins. And with these coins, you can use them like, have you heard of Sweatcoin?
Have I what?
Have you heard of Sweatcoin?
No, I don't think I have.
Okay, so Sweatcoin is an application that counts your steps, and after a certain amount of steps, like 10,000 or 20,000, you get coins, and you can actually buy things from them, like Nike shoes or headphones or a yoga mat or something like that.
Okay.
And that's why it says Sweatcoin. It's trying to animate people to actually work out and move and be aware of how much they're moving or how much they're not moving. And we think we could do something like that as well. If you play the game and you have a certain amount of coins, why not deduct that from your premium? Because it's a win-win situation for everyone. If you are mentally stable and healthy, it's good for you because you're healthy. If you're healthy, it's good for the insurance companies because you're not putting in a claim for mental health care or you're not having accidents or not going to work or something like that. And it's good for us because we're making money at the same time. So There is this, what is it called again? It's called positive capitalism or something like that, where you do make money, but at the same time, you're adding value to people's lives. So it's, you know, everybody's winning.
Yeah, that sounds great. That sounds really good. Let's see, you gave a presentation on artificial intelligence and mental health at a conference. Anything in there that we haven't talked about yet?
I think at the moment we talked about the dangers, we talked about the good parts of it. I think that a lot of people think artificial intelligence is going to take jobs away from therapists, maybe, or it's going to be too cold. But as I see it, for at least the next 10 to 15 years, artificial intelligence is going to help and complement therapy. So the time that you're spending doing a diagnosis and you're not sure if you might have a false positive or a false negative, you could actually be already treatment or establishing a therapeutic alliance with your client. So I think at the moment, artificial intelligence is an intelligence that is so alien to the brain that it will add dimensions that we wouldn't have thought of on our own, which is a good thing.
Okay. Yeah, we should let people know that, as you said earlier, we're at the baby steps era of artificial intelligence, that a lot of people, when they hear artificial intelligence, they go right away to general intelligence. In other words, that would have an intelligence equal or superior to us in terms of general intelligence. Artificial intelligence can be superior in very narrow domains currently. And so it'll be interesting to follow this. I think most experts, well, there's a real division among experts as to whether we will ever achieve general artificial intelligence, or, and other people who say, oh, it's only 20 years away or 30 years away.
20, 30.
That's too close in.
I think it's too close in. And I read a very interesting article about how we need to go into tissues and soft silicons and have a brain-like environment to be able to even have anything close to general artificial intelligence.
Another big science fiction theme. The science fiction movies and books, they've already been there, and we see some of the problems associated with that.
Yeah, it usually doesn't go well.
And at the Cognition X conference, you used a phrase that you used earlier in our interview today, trying to hack the brain's reward system so that people will stick to therapy.
Yeah.
Hack the brain's reward system sounds a little spooky, but helping people stick to therapy, that sounds very positive. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of progress you can make in that domain. Effort.
I think that's one of the big things that artificial intelligence is going to help us do, because what we're going to use at the beginning is classification algorithms, where we can say, okay, we have these classifications of gender, age, what kind of level in the game they've been playing, how long they've been playing, how many coins. And those are like clusters of information that are classified, and then it leads it to new information. And we might not understand, I mean, we know very little about how the brain works. We know a lot, but in total, we still know very little. And by using artificial intelligence to find patterns in the information, the data, we're going to put all the information in there. We're going to classify it in a way that makes sense to us at this point. And then we're going to kind of let the algorithm find new patterns. And that might be something that would be almost classified as hacking, because it's using technology to be able to get deeper into a subject. But I also have to say that in the tech world, hacking is usually, it can be as very bad or very good. So there are hackathons, for example, where people come together in groups and they all sit and they try to develop a program for like a traveling app or a health app or something like that. And hacking has gotten a positive vibe as well, saying like you're using skills to get down to the bottom of something really fast, not going classical routes and, you know, taking shortcuts and just being more efficient.
Yeah. So I'm understanding that that you're interested in using big data sets, as they talk about now, the huge, so much data that a person would be overwhelmed by it using traditional approaches, but that AI can be used and machine learning can be used for pattern recognition.
Yes.
And of course, one of the issues that I'm sure you're aware of is that many times the AI has been a non-transparent black box. And people scratching their heads and saying, okay, well, how did we get there? You know? And this, if we follow those instructions, you know, maybe in the financial world or in the military, you know, and the thing is saying, go do this bad thing. So people are saying, hey, we need to make it transparent. We need to know how the machine reaches those conclusions so that we can better judge whether or not that is going to be a good process or not.
So the way that we're going to outskirt this problem or solve this problem for us is, as long as we're subclinical and we're very, very small, you know, 3,500 participants, for me it sounds huge, but actually for a game it's like nothing, right? Mm-hmm. And it's still the alpha, beta testing. We're going to actually use Microsoft or IBM or one of those other products that already exist as an artificial intelligence because it's much cheaper. But the moment that we're starting to use actual mental health data and treatment, we're going to use bespoke algorithms that were written for us, with us, and that can be reversed. Every step can be reverse engineered so that we can say, we know what happened, when, and why. And also that it is our IP and all the data is in our hands.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the beta testing. Is there any way that my listeners, viewers, could get involved in the beta testing?
Yes, of course. I mean, you could send my email. Anyone who sends me an email will get an invite to the beta. All I need to know is their email and what kind of a phone they have, if they have Apple, Android, or if they use Amazon apps.
Okay, so did you say I could give them your
email address?
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah, my email address, and I have an intern, and if it's too many people, then she's going to have a very unhappy week, but we'll give everyone a beta.
Okay, well, that's a good offer. I think that people who have been listening to this discussion hopefully will feel very curious and motivated and want to get a taste of this EQ game is emerging right now.
Yeah. And if you go into the App Store in Australia and New Zealand, we have over 100 five-star app reviews with people writing wonderful things. And sometimes they, of course, my contact details on the website. So sometimes I get beautiful emails of people saying that they learned something or that it already had an impact on their lives. And that is one of those are one of those moments where I know like I'm on the right path and I am adding value and people, you know, are better for it as am I.
Yeah, that's got to be so gratifying.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Yeah, with all the work that you've put into this.
Yes.
Fundraising
and
everything.
Tears.
So you're getting go signals and green lights.
Yeah.
Maybe you should say that email address that people can, I'll also put it, but maybe somebody might want to get it right this moment.
It's my name, SILJA at EQ Game, EQUOGame.com.
Okay. Well, clearly, I think you're doing wonderful work. It's very intriguing. I'm going to want to talk to you a little bit after we sign off. Is there anything more that you want to say before we officially close this off?
Well, you know, once we go live, maybe you could do a shout out for us, you know, say that the app is actually in the app stores and that they can download it without having to write me an email. That would be lovely. And if anybody has questions or if there are any of your listeners who are researchers and want to become part of the EQ team, once the money is raised, I'm going to put together a team of therapists, accredited therapists that will help design the next level game.
Ah, that's fascinating to know. Yeah. Well, okay, Silja Litvin, I really want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much for having me. This was fun.
What a dynamo Silja Litvin is. Not only is she close to finishing her doctorate in psychology, but she's founder and CEO of her own company, an incredible fundraiser, and sought-after conference speaker. As a result of all of this, she's becoming very visible in the tech industry and soon, I suspect, will be a shining star in psychology. By attending and speaking at all these conferences, she's making very important connections with other tech luminaries and researchers in psychology. She strikes me as very balanced, motivated for success, and wise in the choices she's making. I'm particularly interested in her work because of my own technology leanings. If you're a subscriber to the Shrink Wrap Radio monthly newsletter and read my opening blog essays, you'll know that for the last 6 months or so, I've been writing about the interface, present and future, of artificial intelligence, deep learning, and robotics in relation to psychology and society at large. These essays of mine have also been appearing in Age of Robots magazine, where I'm editor for psychology and society. Silja offered to have her people make a transcript of today's interview, which I will make available on the Shrink Wrap Radio website, and will suggest to publisher Matthew Dalitz that the transcript may also be relevant to his two online magazine publications, The Neuropsychotherapist and Age of Robots, both very authoritative and featuring high production values. Let me remind you, you can get your own beta copy of Silja's emotional fitness game for smartphones called EQ. If you will send her an email at silja@eqgame.com, she'll make you a beta tester and you'll get a full copy of the game. Now let me spell her email address out for you. It's silja@eqoogame.com. Even though she's not calling it a therapy app, instead referring to it as subclinical, I think you'll get a good window into the potential of mobile therapy apps. I think the data she's been receiving from beta testers suggests that it already is a therapy app. As a Shrink Wrap Radio listener, you'll get a preview of where the future of online psychotherapy is headed, or at least a part of it.
Hello, Dr. Dave. It's Claire Edwards from the Sunshine Coast of Queensland, Australia here. I work as a facilitator and coach specializing in neuroleadership and positive psychology. Dr. Dave and your Shrink Wrap Radio form an integral part of my continued professional development. Being based in Australia, it's so convenient for me just to download the podcast and listen at a time convenient to me. I also really enjoy the breadth of experts and the wide range of opinions, which helps me form my own conclusions. Dr. Dave, thanks again for providing such a valuable, insightful, and value-added service.
Thank you, Claire Edwards, there on the Australian Gold Coast. I'm so glad you appreciate the range of guests on Shrink Wrap Radio, and I think today's guest is a good example of that diversity. And I also want to thank you for your donation and encouraging others to follow suit. We do have two new donors since the last podcast, and I want to thank Sean Dunn and Mikhail Gintner. It might be Michael or Mikhail, I'm not sure, but I sure appreciate your regular donation, Mikhail. Thanks again to today's guest, psychologist and entrepreneur, Silja Litvin, for sharing her vision of the future of mobile psychotherapy apps and growth tools. Next week, I'll be speaking with psychotherapist and author Jonathan Robinson about his latest book, More Love, Less Conflict, A Communication Playbook for Couples. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.